rock steady, Aretha Franklin, man. You gotta love Aretha. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. Here till 4, keeping you informed, keeping you company, and helping us all get through this, and we will get through it. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Coming up after 1 o'clock. Or so, Dr. Karen Phillip is going to join us. She is an international author, and she's on parenting, relationships, professional counseling, psychotherapist, and clinical hypnotherapist. And we're going to talk about handling this situation and how it's going, and talking to kids about it, and how relationships are being stressed because you're stuck together. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But you're home a lot. And that means a lot of people are watching TV, and more than ever. And so we need to do some TV talk, which we do anyway every couple of weeks. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, joins us to talk TV. And so, hello, Dan.
Hello, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you holding up?
Oh, glued to my couch. I would say same as usual, but you know, it's a little fatiguing. Let's just be honest. We're all trying to keep our spirits up, and it's a little fatiguing.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, you know, it's weird because, I'm here in the studio, so I leave my place, come here, do the show, go directly back, and just stay in the whole time, and it is a little bit crazy. But we've been, you know, that means a lot of people are watching TV, though, Dan.
Oh, heaven knows. That's as I keep saying, America has become a nation of TV critics, so I'm just one of many.
Yes. Well, we've got some TV stuff to talk about, as we do every month. Now, have you been binging anything? No, well, you have enough to watch already, right?
I have not really been binging anything. I've been trying my hardest to kind of keep on top of everything. That's just all I'm doing is trying to make sure that I'm actually on top of the things that I didn't have screeners for, or that I didn't review, to make sure that I'm still at least conversant about things. So I'm keeping track on whatever nonsense is happening on Westworld, or making sure that I've at least watched what's happening on Killing Eve, even though my colleague reviewed it. So, you know, trying to stay afloat as best I can. There's been no slowdown thus far, at least on the TV
front. And the TV front, absolutely. So, and by the way, everybody should check out The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, for all the latest reviews. Okay, Dan, let's talk about this is something that this city is going to be very interested in. The Last Dance on ESPN. Tell us about The Last Dance.
Yes, The Last Dance has been long anticipated. They announced this one like 2 years before it was going to premiere, and then they actually just bumped it up from June to now. It is ESPN, and Netflix is the co-producer on it. They're distributing it internationally, but it's airing on ESPN here. It premieres on Sunday, and it is directed by Jason Hayher. I think that's how his last name is pronounced. Probably not exactly, if we're being honest, but it's basically the story of the 1997-1998 Bulls, the team that was trying to, as of course your listeners know, complete the second three-peat in an eight-year period for the Bulls. And it was the year that people were whispering about whether or not Michael Jordan was about to retire again. Everyone already knew that Jerry Krause was ready to move on from Phil Jackson after that season. Scottie Pippen sat out the first half of the season with an injury and a salary dispute. So it was a whole season about, will the Bulls be able to get it back together for one last dance, as it were? So it's a 10-hour documentary, and that's probably more than anyone needed just about the 1997-1998 Bulls, but the director does a very good job of weaving in both, basically, you know, it's primarily going to be Michael Jordan's story. We all know this.
Yeah.
But also making sure that there are episodes that are focused on Scottie Pippen, that are focused on Dennis Rodman, that are focused on Phil Jackson. It works its way through the first three championships. It covers, of course, the baseball season and Michael Jordan's attempts to play baseball. And it's full of great footage. So it's a fantastic opportunity to just be reminded that watching Michael Jordan play basketball is tremendously fun. And then there are lots and lots of great interviews. Michael Jordan sat down with the director for a fairly long time, and he's as candid as he ever is. He's not really ever been the most candid of people. He's always been very much about the Michael Jordan brand, and that doesn't change here. But, you know, the director asks him a lot of the questions that people have, whether or not there are going to be answers. So there are questions about things like, was the 18 months that he stepped away from the Bulls between those championship seasons, was it really an NBA suspension that no one wanted to call it? That kind of thing. So it's a lot of fun. My biggest reservation, honestly, is that it's not OJ Made in America, and it's too bad that I have to compare everything to that documentary, but yeah, it's so great that I'm just going to. But it's really fun, and it's really entertaining, and a lot of the interviews are really terrific. Jordan has some moments where he's actually really good and candid, even if a lot of it feels canned. But yeah, it's very entertaining. I would say that probably the city of Chicago, as kind of a nebulous concept, gets a little bit shortchanged. It's not really about the impact that Jordan and the Bulls had on the city per se, but it's really good. And if people have been looking forward to this, and, you know, heaven knows people are missing sporting events of all kinds, yeah, this will fill a gap.
Yeah. Well, I no doubt in my mind that, you know, the city's going to go nuts when it comes on. I mean, we're all stuck inside, and this is just going to be so great to go back and celebrate the glory of the 90s Bulls. So.
No, it is very, very entertaining, and it covers a lot of the things you would want it to. It covers, you know, the big shots, the big games. It acknowledges the existence of Space Jam. It covers the Dream Team. There's a lot of stuff happening in this. I really did just watch 8 hours in pretty much a day and a half. Unfortunately, most viewers won't be able to do that up front. It's airing 2 episodes per week on Sunday nights.
Okay.
Down the road, people can binge.
Okay. ESPN this Sunday night. That's something to look forward to. All right. Dan, hold on.
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and we always talk about TV. That's The Last Dance on ESPN. It'll be on Sunday night, covering basically the 97-98 Bulls and Michael Jordan and all of that other stuff. People are going to watch it like crazy in this city. There's no question about it. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you want to jump in. Dan Feinberg, more TV to talk about. And if you have questions, we'd love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Talk and text.
Are we really sure? Can a love that lasted for so long? Distractions going on elsewhere.
You fool me every time you play this. Every time you play this bump, you fool me, and I think it's going to be Ice Cube.
The day that it's Ice Cube, I don't know. I can't even envision that day.
Jeez.
I wish it were sometimes, but.
Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Not that I don't enjoy that song, because I do, but I think Ice Cube immediately when I hear that riff. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Joining us a little bit later on will be Dr. Karen Phillip, an international author on parenting and relationships, professional counseling, psychotherapist, and clinical hypnotherapist. And we're going to talk about how people are dealing with the isolation, the personal impact that everything is having, talking to kids about the situation. Lots of stuff to talk with the doctor about. 312-981-7200, talk and text. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for Hollywood Reporter, joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. And Dan, hi.
I also thought it was going to be Ice Cube.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. Let's talk about some of the other things that that you've been reviewing. What about Outer Banks?
Outer Banks premiered on Netflix on Wednesday, and it is. I described it as Netflix's latest nostalgia in a blender series. So you could sort of flip a coin on 15 different influences. It's a little bit like, you got to start with Goonies, but then it's a little bit like Goonies meets The O.C. meets Dawson's Creek. It's not as good as any of those things, but that's kind of what it is. It is set in North Carolina, in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and it's the story of a group of blue-collar kids. They call themselves Pokes, and the fact that they don't say Pokes never say die is just because they assume everyone watching it is going to say it already on their own. And one of the Pokes' fathers, this Poke in question, his name is John B., and yet no one makes a single Slip John B. reference the entire time, which suggests that I'm old, I guess. his father was basically a treasure hunter. There was an urban legend or a story of a British ship that went down with $400 million in British gold. And the father vanished, but he left a number of clues that may lead to that ship, which may allow these blue-collar kids to basically escape their rundown existence and change their lives. But there's a whole class warfare thing going on with the rich kids on the island, who are called the Kooks, but wouldn't you know it, one of the Pokes and one of the Kooks just might fall in love. I mean, go figure. It's a ton of cliches. It's sometimes a lot of fun to kind of check off the individual references that are very clearly being made. And I think there's a lot of fun to be had in that. I think that on its own, it falls apart at a number of different points, namely that none of the actors, most of whom are relative unknowns, are particularly good. They're all very attractive, and the show spends a lot of time with them in bathing suits or running around topless in the case of the men or jiggling in the case of the women, but it's still sort of PG-13-ish, I guess. But no, none of the actors are great, and that takes away a lot. Also, it kind of gets really, really dumb and silly and cartoonish in the last couple hours, but I think some people will be amused by it. And so that's why you just sort of got to give all the references and go, if the idea of Goonies meets The O.C. meets a little bit of Red Dawn meets Dawson's Creek sounds good to you, give it a shot. I mean, people are just sitting around watching stuff on TV anyway, so what's the harm?
Okay, so that's Outer Banks, and it's on Netflix now. So you could binge this, right? I mean, it's all there.
It is. All 10 episodes available. It definitely is not designed as a limited series. It sets itself up for a hypothetical second season, and I get the feeling that some people are going to get a kick out of it. I think that as Netflix exercises in nostalgia go, it's nowhere near as good as, for example, Stranger Things. It's not even, you know, in the same hemisphere as that. But, you know, some people are going to not have issues with wooden performances and with the strange fact that everything is shot in a sort of golden tint the entire time. It's like everything is shot in the gloaming. It's 6 o'clock in the evening, every single shot in the entire series. And, you know, it's an aesthetic choice. It's a somewhat silly aesthetic choice, but sometimes it's pretty. So There's that. Some people will be amused by it.
Okay, there you go. And that's available on Netflix right now. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. If you've got like a TV question or a comment, we would love to hear from you. Dan Feinberg is here. Dan, Modern Family aired its final episode. And you talk a little bit about the legacy that's left behind.
I think that Modern Family is one of those shows, and this happens with some frequency, that kind of stayed around long enough that a lot of the affection that a lot of people had for it dwindled. Mm-hmm. And so whatever the passion was that people felt for that show in the first, say, 3 or 4 seasons, a lot of people kind of shifted into the, oh, that show's still on, or, oh, I stopped watching it in season 6, 7, 8, wherever. And those people weren't wrong. I would say that after season 4, probably, the show became really, really inconsistent. And then some of those later seasons, I would say it generally was pretty bad. But the last season was much more effective. It was much more driven by the heart and the emotional moments than some of the middle seasons, where maybe fell down on being overly farce-driven. But the finale brought home a lot of the things that were introduced in the pilot and throughout the series, a lot of the emotional things, a lot of the family ties. And I think, you know, you look at some of the things that the show achieved. For example, when is the next time we're going to see a broadcast television show win the drama series or comedy series Emmy? It's who knows when that might happen next. Mm-hmm. And Modern Family won 4 or 5 in a row, which was a little ridiculous at the time also, but still, it's significant. And then you just look at all of the wonderful family comedies on ABC that got to exist in large part because Modern Family was such a success, because it set the template, because it brought in the audience. So without Modern Family, you don't get The Middle, you don't get The Goldbergs, you don't get Fresh Off the Boat, you don't get Speechless, you don't get a lot of these just great family comedies that every other network has been trying to replicate and failing at, and that ABC had a dozen of in the past 10 or 15 years, thanks in large part to Modern Family. I think it's an important show.
Yeah. Well, all I know is that the night of the finale, my news feed was filled with people who were crying. Like they were crying their eyes out at the finale of Modern Family. That seemed to be the purveying sentiment.
It was always a show that was perfectly happy to get to the end and make you cry. If there weren't necessarily laughs in the middle, it was always happy to come together in a big emotional moment if that's what they wanted to do. And there's no question the final season was about those big moments. It was about the family members making decisions about whether to stay together or whether to leave, and they were all growing up and all of that stuff. It wasn't like it was shocking in any particular way, but there were a lot of hugs, there were a lot of tear-filled goodbyes, and most of them really stuck, and most of them stuck because, for all of that, the cast was always so good. You know, from Ed O'Neill on down, it was just one of the wonderful comedy ensembles on TV, and so many of even the kids kind of grew up and became valuable participants in the ensemble over the years. So I understand people invested a lot of time in these families, and the finale honored that investment of time if you stuck with it the whole way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was a show that I never really watched. And how many seasons was it on? Like 10 or 11?
11, I think. It was on for a long time, and it was not good for the second half of its run, and it probably didn't deserve a couple of those comedy series Emmys, and definitely some of the acting Emmys that it took away from probably better shows and better performances. But I would say if you look at the first couple seasons, it is a wonderful example of how to do a broadcast show with a certain level of sophistication, but also a very wide reach. It was always a broadcast TV show. It was not a niche show. It was not a Baskets where 75 people were going to like it, but they were going to love it. It was a show that played to the entire audience.
Yeah.
And for a long time, it did it really well.
I did watch the first couple of seasons of Modern Family, and I happen to be a really big Ed O'Neill fan. I love him, and it was a great cast all the way through. And I really enjoyed watching it for the first couple of seasons. It was one of those shows that I just kind of I left it behind at one point.
Well, there was never like a strong, compelling mythology to it, where if you didn't tune in the next week, you would lose it. But no, Ed O'Neill was always wonderful on it, and I would say he was the best part of the finale. I would say a lot of the people who were crying at the end were crying because Ed O'Neill nailed several big moments. And it's a little sad that that he wasn't one of the people who won Emmys for the show. He was always top of the call sheet and all of that, but yeah, the Emmys went to other people.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Dan Feinberg is here, and we're talking TV. If you have a question or a comment TV related, we'd love to hear from you. We got a couple of texts that have come in. We'll get some calls if you want to jump in here. It's 312-981-7200. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Check him out at The Fine Print, FIEN. He joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. And we're stuck inside watching a lot of TV, and we'll talk about that as well. 312-981-7200. I've often said it. You can't go wrong with Earth, Wind, and Fire. Ever. Ever. You can't go wrong with Earth, Wind, and Fire. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Nick DiGilio here. Here until 4 o'clock. My guest coming up at after 1-ish is Dr. Karen Phillip. She's an international author on parenting and relationships, a professional counseling psychotherapist, and a clinical hypnotherapist. And we're going to talk about the situation that we're in right now and how we can deal with it, and especially with kids and stuff. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. And a lot of people, you know, are watching a lot of TV because we're stuck inside. So TV is going to be a big thing for everybody. You can follow him at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Okay, Dan, we got a couple of texts here.
Excellent. Bring them on.
847 area code says, what did Dan think of Briar Patch? This is the show on USA with Rosario Dawson.
I thought it was okay. It was never exactly one thing long enough for me to embrace it. And, like, I understand that it wanted to be simultaneously a quirky, oddball, Twin Peaks-y kind of community-type show, and then also an effective mystery-type show with a Southwestern setting. And to me, it was neither weird and creepy and Twin Peaks-y enough, nor effective enough as a hard-boiled mystery. I really like J.R. Ferguson, who had a great supporting role. I thought Rosario Dawson was solid. I thought it generally looked great. I just wanted it to be one thing or the other, just a little bit better, I think.
Okay. 847 area code sent in a text that said, will there be a fourth season of Ozark?
It has not been renewed yet, so that is the first thing, and Netflix really doesn't renew things exactly these days, so it's not a surprise, and definitely no one should think it's worrisome. Also, in the middle of our current situations, they may be waiting, you know, until they have a better sense of when they'd actually begin production again. So it has not been renewed, but it is a show that is well enough received in general that has a certain amount of awards cachet, and also, without spoiling anything, the third season ends in a cliffhanger that I will be annoyed if they don't get a fourth season, and that is a bizarre thing for me to say as someone who was very loudly critical of Ozark, especially in its second season. I thought the third season had real moments and at times worked fairly well. Take it as you will, coming from someone who was not a big fan before.
Okay. But you know, it's interesting, a lot of the questions that we get from listeners via text or phone calls are questions about when a show is going to return. We should preface this by saying nobody knows, because everything is shut down. There's no production on anything. That's the reality of the situation. We're not sure when anything is going to be back to production.
And there are so many shows where you simply don't know. You know, even if they were two-thirds of the way into production, something like Fargo, they were deep into production on it, but they weren't so deep that they were finished. And there are a lot of shows that were in that situation where they were probably an episode or two from finishing seasons, and they had to stop. And so, it's tough.
Another question here, 312, same kind of question. Will Big Little Lies on HBO have a third season?
That is one where it has not been renewed, and there was some question after the first season if it was a limited series, which is where it won various awards and whatnot, or whether it had the potential to be an ongoing series, and HBO was always, oh, no, it's a limited series, until basically they renewed it. And then the second season, it's going to be submitted for Emmy consideration as a drama. There's no choice. It can't be a limited series again, so at least on the surface, it is a continuing series. It has not been renewed, and it's just one of those things where there are so many actors involved, and they all have other things they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, Reese Witherspoon has 17 TV shows.
Right.
Has 12 TV shows. Right. Meryl Streep is Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
So if someone at some point decides, oh, we've got a story, probably would have to be David E. Kelly, obviously, and everybody was actually somehow available and thought it would be fun to do it again, I'm sure HBO would say, sure, come back and do it again. But it definitely, it, there's not an immediate plan to do it again.
Okay. All right. You know, Dan, tell us about Broke on CBS.
Well, the first thing I can say about Broke is that I barely remember it exists. And I definitely did review it. And I probably didn't even review it that long ago because it must have premiered last week or something. So that's all you need to know about Broke. No, Broke is a CBS sitcom. And it is the latest in basically the spring trend of various family members run out of money and have to move in with other family members. In this case, Polly Perrette from NCIS plays a single mother and bartender, and her sister, played by Natasha Leggero, and her brother-in-law, played by Jaime Camille from She and the Virgin, basically lose their money and have to move back in with the family. It is a lot of very, very predictable jokes about this predicament. Unfortunately, Polly Perrette, not really all that funny in a multi-cam context. Jaime Camille is basically playing Rogelio de la Vega, who played on Jane the Virgin so very wonderfully, but the character doesn't really work as well in this circumstance. There are some moments of decent emotional heart in it, which makes it better than something like NBC's Indebted, which has a comparable plot and was really horrible. This is just not very good and just kind of lax and uninspired, which is too bad because I like a lot of the actors in it, but very little to recommend it other than that people have a lot of time on their hands.
Yeah, okay. I happen to be a really big fan of Natasha Leggero, so that was the reason why I was curious about it.
She is pretty good here, and it's, you know, it's one of those things where you look and you go, you see her doing scenes with Polly Perrette, and you go, okay, one of these two people is an extraordinarily trained comic veteran who knows exactly what to do with even flimsy, flaccid punchlines, and she's going to give everything she has, and she's going to try to make sure you laugh. And the other one is just, you know, an actor, but not really a comic actor per se, who just doesn't know how to do the same things. Natasha Leggero is incredibly funny and incredibly talented and has rather strikingly not been used all that well over the years in most of the things she's done, unfortunately.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I've been, you know, like as a stand-up, she's great. And, you know, whenever she appears on talk shows or, you know, when she was on At Midnight and things like that, always funny. Always very
funny. And when she pops up as stars on shows, I almost always find her appealing. It's just the vehicles that she's gotten. For the most part, she's been stuck playing kind of the brassy sister in a generic sitcom, and I feel like she's probably done like 15 of those over the years, and it's just never what she deserves. She did have Comedy Central, another period show that she did, and that was much better because she basically was helping creatively steer the show. And,
yeah.
You know, imagine that.
Yeah.
But I wish more people could find better use for it.
Yeah. She's always great on, you know, the Comedy Central stuff that she does is that's in her wheelhouse. And like she's great on drunk History, always really funny on that. And it's always, I just think she's a delight. That's all. I just think she's great.
Probably you can still skip this one.
Yeah, no, I know. I just looked. I, you know, when I saw her in it, I was like, oh, well, that's cool. But then I saw what it was about, and I was like, oh. And, you know, that it was a CBS half-hour sitcom, and I was like, oh, man. Well, at least she's getting paid, I guess. You know?
Oh, to be some. But if it only lasts, you know, the spring, and I don't imagine at this point it's going to be back, but who the heck knows. Not that lucrative, but it's still a paycheck. So
why is there suddenly these shows, these sitcoms about people losing money and moving in with the family? How has that become a thing?
It's somewhat baffling is the thing, because you figure that all of these shows were put into development basically last spring, last winter, at the time at which our president and other people were talking about how the economy was the best economy in history and all of that. Well, obviously some writers did have a sense that there was a weakness in the economy, and a weakness that has, I mean, it's manifested itself in recent months, obviously,
right,
in tragic conditions, you know? And so I think, honestly, these shows have somehow managed to look significantly more timely as a result of something nobody could have predicted than they possibly could have seemed when they were all in development. So you've got this, you've got Indebted, as I mentioned. There's a ABC comedy that I think is coming out this summer with Will Sasso, which also is not very good, but has a somewhat comparable premise. So somebody knew something in Hollywood last spring, or just got very, very lucky.
Yeah. Okay. All right. 319 area code says, I think CBS's Monday comedies of the Neighborhood and Bob Hart's Abbasola are really good network offerings. Any thoughts?
I think the Neighborhood's okay. I think it's, I don't know that it's quite as good as its stars should make it be. I don't watch it regularly, but when I tune in, I find it okay. Bob Hart's Abbasola, I watched 6 episodes and kept seeing the show I wanted it to be around the edges and kept seeing it not become that. At some point, I will check back in on it. CBS is not a disastrous place for comedy. It really isn't. I, you know, was hit and miss over the years on Big Bang Theory, but I think that Young Sheldon is a way above average single-cam family comedy. I think it does a lot of things very well. I continue to think that Mom is a terrific show, and that, and you know, it's been on at this point forever, and it continues to every once in a while deliver an emotional episode that is just stunning for a multi-cam comedy. And obviously Allison Janney and Anna Faris are always great. So the CBS does have a mixed track record, and they have a lot of bad stuff, but they do some decent stuff too, and they get big stars because the potential of CBS sitcom money is very much a good thing.
Okay. All right, Dan, hang on. Dan Feinberg is with us. Follow him on the Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We got more TV to talk about. And if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200 for Talk and Text.
If you ever see the boy from me,
Patty Drew, tell him. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's Nick DiGilio live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. Coming up a little bit later on, Dr. Karen Phillip is going to join us. We're going to talk about, she's a clinical hypnotherapist and a psychotherapist, and we're going to talk about the effect that this crisis is having on families. We'll talk about how you deal with it with your kids and handling relationships when you're stuck inside. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are also going to talk about 30 outdated problems that no one today can relate to anymore. And for as far as our Carson classics, we always play a bit from the Johnny Carson Show, which you can watch on Antenna TV every night. Joan Rivers, an interview from 1986. She was always great on the show before the big falling out between her and Johnny. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Dan Feinberg joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. TV critic for the Hollywood Reporter. And hello, Dan.
Hello, Nick.
All right. We have somebody on the line who has a question. Here's John. Hi, John.
Hi. Dan, would you know if PBS is planning on putting out a replacement business show to take the place of Nightly Business Report, which they canceled about a month or so ago?
The simple answer to that is going to be that right now is not going to be the time anyone's going to be doing that. So I don't know what the answer is long term. This is just such a bad time to be attempting to launch a new show. I'm trying to think if anyone is even doing it in the news space, because there's just no way to test anything. There's no way to make anything new work. So if there's a gap in the programming, I assume it will have to be filled after the unpleasantness ends.
Okay, there you go. John, thank you for the call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Tell us about Deadwater Fell.
Deadwater Fell is the first review I've ever written for an Acorn show. Acorn is owned by the AMC family, and it's a streaming service that has a vast reservoir of British and adjacent dramas and comedies. I would say roughly in the same conversation as BritBox, which has a similar assortment of things. I sort of carved out time to review this one because it has a very good cast, including David Tennant and Cush Jumbo from The Good Fight, which returned this week, incidentally. And it's a four-episode small-town Scottish mystery where a perfect Scottish town is shocked and horrified when a fire claims the life of the beloved local doctor's wife and beautiful children. But was their life so perfect? Hint: no, it was probably not. It's a good, solid mystery that has enough nuance and detail around the main who did it and why did it to make it more interesting than it might sound on the surface. The surface is kind of, to use the pejorative, to call it a bit of a Lifetime movie, but it's very clearly aware of those conventions and tries to make sure that it's more about the small town, it's more about the characters. David Tennant is having a lot of fun being enigmatic and possibly evil, but maybe just misunderstood. He's very good. Cush Jumbo is very good. It's nicely atmospheric, and the location shooting in Scotland is good. And again, at only four episodes and 45 minutes per episode, it's a good, quick watch if you have Acorn and you like the kind of programming they have, which is, you know, a lot of British type mysteries, which, you know, the British do very, very well. That's a genre that some people love, and I assume the people who love that genre most already know about Acorn and probably know about Deadwater Fell.
Okay, Deadwater Fell. I love David Tennant. I'm a huge fan. I just think
he's good, and it's fun. Always fun whenever someone actually lets him speak with his regular accent, which happens so very rarely. But he's nicely Scottish here.
There you go. 781 says, okay, just tonight. Season finales of Chicago Med, Fire, and PD seem just like regular episodes, not finales or cliffhangers. Why?
I suspect the answer with those ones is the same as with a lot of shows that they weren't designed as season finales, and they became season finales when production wasn't finished on the last couple episodes.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, people are going to discover that with a lot of their favorite shows over the next month, is a lot of shows are still going to end in April and May, as you expect them to, but a lot of them aren't going to end in the way you expect them to. If you expect a big cliffhanger or the big wedding or a big childbirth, all the things that we expect in our May sweeps episodes of television, those episodes were written and put into pre-production, but in most cases they just weren't shot or weren't finished. And either those episodes, the scripts will get used at the start of next season, or who knows. But I think people are going to discover that a lot over the next few weeks.
Yeah.
It's shows that are closing on unsatisfying terms.
Yeah, that's too bad. You know, but we can't do anything about it. We just got to wait it out.
Nope.
The only thing that is new on TV are the late night shows, which I've been watching.
There's still a pretty fair amount of other, I mean, you know, there's still like all the FX stuff, obviously, and all of that. But you were talking about late night shows. Which,
Have you been watching the late night shows? Because I find it, I don't know, I think these guys are doing a great job, and I find it endlessly amusing that they're at home. I don't know why I find that just so amusing.
I'm enjoying with all of these, whether it's the late night shows or the news shows, when people have to Skype in or Zoom in or whatever technology anyone's using, you know, seeing how people present their living rooms and seeing where in their houses people are able to shoot these remote segments. I always find that amusing. And so seeing John Oliver doing his white void, wherever that is.
Right.
Seeing Seth Meyers shoot in whatever hallway he's shooting in, or I've been loving the way Desus and Mero have been shooting, with Desus shooting in front of his shoe collection and Mero basically shooting apparently in his basement. it's you know, on one hand it's sad, on the other hand it's people trying and people just pushing really hard to make laughter out of uncomfortable, awful situations, and I applaud them all.
John Oliver's appearance on Seth Meyers' show was just awesome. Just, I mean, well, John Oliver in general is awesome, but just his appearance on Seth Meyers was great. And Seth Meyers is having some fun too, because he's doing it like in his upstairs sort of attic. And there's that weird small door that people are wondering what it is. And so they were wondering, he said, it's not at all where I keep my children. You know, and then all of a sudden the door opens up and his two little kids come running out, and he's also having fun because on the side table, like sort of behind him, he keeps adding copies of the Thornbirds, the book, which is just so funny.
And, I think, for example, that Trevor Noah got tired of explaining what the two ornamental balls were behind
right,
him.
Right.
For the first few episodes, he was doing it each episode, and then he stopped. I think he felt like he played that joke out. But he is, however, having a lot of fun with the quarantining tip of the day that he gives at the start of each episode. I've been enjoying those a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch this stuff. I mean, it's, you know, it's just, it's crazy. It's just so surreal and weird. And what did you think of SNL this past week?
I thought they tried hard, and I appreciated the effort, and I wrote a column about it for THR, talked about how this is a show that is experienced with handling darkness and tragedy. It's a show that came back a couple weeks after 9/11 and found a way to make jokes. It's a show that has obviously had to deal with all of the deaths of cast members. It feels like they're constantly putting up a tribute placard at the end of episodes for all the beloved people from the SNL family, you know, even if it's just hosts and stuff who passed away. So they know how to walk the line. I think there was only so much material that they had, so there were a couple of good sketches. It was great to see Tom Hanks at the top.
Yeah,
of the
absolutely, absolutely. I was genuinely surprised too, and I was so glad to see that he's doing okay.
And he was just, you know, the perfect person for this moment, both because he's, you know, a patron saint of SNL as a host, obviously, and also because of his own coronavirus diagnosis. So he was the perfect person to be hosting this, and he was great, and it was just a good welcome in the intro to the show. I thought Chris Martin was fine. I thought his Bob Dylan cover was decent.
Yeah.
You know, it did what it was supposed to do. There were a lot of sketches that didn't work. I thought the first half of Weekend Update with the people laughing over Zoom just didn't work. Mm-hmm. But then at the end, when Michael Che started talking about his grandmother who died from the coronavirus, it just was such a gut punch. And then the final segment, paying tribute to the show's music supervisor, who also died last week, I thought that was wonderful, and all the people they brought in. And it was just a great reminder of all of the people who work on the show and have worked on the shows for decades, and who are these incredibly important figures in making the show happen every week, and who we never know their names, we never see them.
Right.
But then when something like this happens and you see how loved these people were, you know, Pete Davidson's voice cracking, it moved me. And so the couple sketches that were awful, whatever, they took 3 minutes.
Yeah.
But that they did it.
Okay. All right, Dan. Hang on. We got the news coming up, and then more with Dan Feinberg.
Working on a night move, trying to make some front page driving news. Working on a night move in the summertime.
Night Moves. Bob Seger. Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline Studio here till 4 o'clock, keeping you entertained and keeping you informed and staying with you as we get through this, and we will get through this. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We've been talking with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Nick.
Aaron from Waukegan says, I love SEAL Team. Have you heard anything about it coming back for season 4?
It is very much in that limbo that everyone else is in, and we are approaching what would typically be the upfront season where all of these decisions would be made, and that would normally be early to mid-May, and instead, unclear. If I had to guess, I would guess that is a successful enough show for CBS that it'll be back. That would just be a guess, though.
Okay. 847 said Pete Davidson looked normal, which is nice to see.
Well, he's stuck inside with his mother for 24 hours a day. If anything is going to be good for Pete Davidson, it's this situation.
Yeah.
So let's all keep an eye on Pete Davidson and make sure he's being healthy. But yes, he definitely seemed as if he was somewhat more under control. I wish his songs had been a little bit funnier. I don't understand why the not very funny Drake song was the opening sketch of the episode, but oh well.
Any idea how shows like, again, this is all, speculation, any idea how shows like The Voice or American Idol will complete their seasons?
American Idol is going to do, we're going to see what it actually looks like, but they are doing a social distanced version of the top 20, and I am very curious to see what it looks like. It is going to be strange, but they are attempting it, and it will be very different not having them playing in front of a screaming crowd.
There's a
chance that maybe it means that the people with more nuanced artistic talent might end up doing better, but I am personally very interested to see what those episodes are going to look like, and I assume The Voice is going to do something comparable, but as I am a American Idol viewer and not a Voice viewer, I'm not as invested in that, but I'm looking forward to seeing what Idol is going to try doing.
That is going to be really interesting. I may tune in for that just to see how they handle it.
I hope it's not awful.
Okay.
But who knows?
All right. Okay. Let's see. Here's Don on WGN. Go ahead, Don.
Hi, Nick. How you doing?
All right.
Hi, Dan. I had a question for you. I was just wondering on NCIS, LA. I know her name, but I can't think of it. But I know her as Nell. Is she going to be back on the program? You think she's going to stay, or is she going to leave?
I do not know, and that's another one of those shows where I'm pretty sure I believe that they didn't actually finish the season they were trying to finish. So the answer to almost all questions is we don't know.
Yeah.
And we're just going to have to see, and there are going to be so many decisions that are going to have to be made under circumstances that have nothing to do with what the industry has basically been built around all of these years, and we're going to see if that's actually somehow better for it. The pilot season process that they do each year in broadcast television is insanely expensive. It is not by any stretch of the imagination the most efficient way to do the thing they do, and they're not going to be able to do it this year, so what are they going to do? Maybe they'll find a better way to do it, or maybe next fall will just be a TV disaster.
Okay. Thanks, Don, for the call. Thank you, Don. 312-981-7200. Okay, tell us about Home Before Dark.
Home Before Dark is Apple TV Plus, and it's really just a good, solid family mystery type show. It is a premiere 2 weeks ago, I believe, and I believe it premiered in binge form, so you can check it out. And it's based on the life of inspired by the life of Hildy Lisiak, whose father was a journalist, and she started basically writing a little broadsheet newspaper when she was 9 or 10 and started scooping the local papers and started solving stories that no one else could solve. And Home Before Dark is a fairly straightforward in that respect mystery more than anything else, because it's hard to distinguish between what a journalist does and what a juvenile detective does. But it stars Brooklyn Prince, who people will know from The Florida Project.
Yeah.
And if people don't know her from The Florida Project, people should watch The Florida Project.
Yep.
It's just a great movie. And she's just a really talented young actress. She is simply an actress and not just a precocious kid. And the show could not exist without her. It is a show focused around a 9-year-old journalist, and if you don't have an actress who can carry the show, it does not work, and she carries the show. In my review, what I said was, imagine if after making E.T., Steven Spielberg had decided to do an adaptation of Harriet the Spy starring Drew Barrymore. I think that is sort of the idea of how it treats the young actors in a way that isn't condescending, that treats them just as actual humans, which has always been one of the things that Spielberg has done best, is working with young actors and just getting these great, natural, unforced performances out of them and not treating them like, you know, little Muppets. You know, even Drew Barrymore, who was as, you know, as much a Hollywood kid as there was at the time, that's just a great performance in E.T. that she gives.
Yeah.
And
so
I would say this is, you know, it's not that good, obviously, because, come on, that would be tremendous. But it's a good mystery. There's a lot of nice atmospheric stuff about it, and Brooklyn Prince is great. And it's a show that is about a kid, but it's not really aimed at the youngest of viewers. It's probably aimed at co-viewing, and since a lot of people are doing co-viewing these days, I think that if families got together and watched the show, there are many worse things that people could sit around the TV and binge.
Yeah, and I happen to be, for some reason, I'm like a huge Jim Sturgess fan.
You love Across the Universe.
I do.
I find him a little bit hit and miss, and I think that he's great with Brooklyn Prince. They have a really nice dynamic, father-daughter dynamic between them. When he's on his own, I find him really kind of dull, but he's very good with Brooklyn Prince.
Well, that's good. That's good. Okay, well, listen, Dan, I always appreciate it. Stay safe, man, and we'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Maybe we'll be able to get out of the house by then. Who knows?
Knock on wood, stay safe and sane.
Okay, buddy, take care. There you go. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. A lot of people are watching TV. We're stuck inside TV, and it's always great to talk with Dan Feinberg.